Jamie, I said again to the little blue eyes looking up at me. Hello, Mum, said his scrunched-up, wrinkled little face. Oh, joy. It was the best feeling in the world. To hell with the rude staff. My world was right here in my arms. No one was going to ruin the best day of my life. Later, with Jamie asleep on my lap, an older night nurse visited me and explained why they were being so mean. She confided that they all thought I'd coerced Tabitha into giving him up. They assumed she would be distraught and upset by giving up a baby. In fact, she was absolutely delighted with her job and was handling it very well. She was over the moon to have achieved a healthy baby boy for us after all we'd been through. I hear them talking in the staff room. They just don't understand. None of them have ever seen a surrogacy arrangement before. I think it's an amazing story, so just try and ignore them. Don't let them upset you. I tried, but they had already tainted what should have been a completely wonderful experience. It was only one night, I told myself. I had a lifetime of joyous evenings ahead of me. That night, I didn't get a wink of sleep. I was savouring every moment staring at my little man, so calm and peaceful in my arms. I was full of awe for this tiny little thing, so totally dependent on me. I was a mum. Wow. The next morning, the bed manager stormed into my room, furious. She shouted angry words at me, but I really wasn't in the slightest bit bothered. She could be as cross as she liked. Frankly, I couldn't give a flying fruitcake. Her words just washed off me. Surely it isn't policy to split up a mother from her child, I said. I will be writing to the hospital manager about your despicable treatment of me, and you can have your bed back right now. We are not staying a moment longer. I phoned Andrew to bring the car round with the new baby seat. I needed to be home. We packed our bags and left. Tabitha came with us, all four of us leaving the tense atmosphere behind. As we left, we roared with laughter at the attitude of the staff and the furious bed manager. You had to see the funny side. I was elated to finally be home with our baby boy. A baby boy! My baby boy! When it came to Sam's birth, again by the same amazing angel Tabitha, 3 years later, we had no intention of repeating the same sorry birth experience. We chose Kingston Hospital instead. We'd learnt a lot and realised that the staff needed coaching, so they were given a full list of what to do's if anything went wrong during the birth and a brief on how we expected to be treated. We made it clear that if Sam needed to stay in hospital and Tabitha was fine to go home, that I was to stay instead of her. The staff present at Sam's birth could not have been more different. Sam's arrival was greeted with the kind of joy and happiness from the midwives I had expected with Jamie, not with stares of disdain. Sam's birth was far easier, and the staff even allowed me to deliver him. An amazing experience. Another perfect little boy. Our family was complete. The family I had always yearned for and thought I would never have. I felt so blessed and so lucky. I was overcome with love, totally smitten by them both. The struggle for a family had been long, painful, difficult, and expensive. After giving up on egg donation, we had contacted COTS again and asked if they had any surrogates prepared to offer straight surrogacy where the surrogate self-inseminates. We were introduced to Tabitha a few months later, and I knew instantly she was right for us. She was warm, open-hearted, and was doing it for all the right reasons. Tabitha, herself a midwife with a child of her own, made it abundantly clear that she wanted to do it for us because she had lost friends to cancer. She explained she was surrounded by babies every day and that she would find it easier. I must say I wasn't entirely convinced by this, but as I got to know her better, we developed an amazing sense of sisterhood. She really is an incredible, selfless person. From then on, I had organic deliveries sent to Tabitha's house every week, provided her with multivitamins, folate, probiotics, massage, and reflexology. I wanted her to feel as special as she was. Even then, we had 3 failed pregnancies and 2 years of trying before we finally achieved a healthy pregnancy. On each failed occasion, I expected Tabitha to turn around and say she'd had enough. But every time she told us resolutely she would carry on and try again. Like me, she was not a quitter. I love that woman. When we got home from the audition, Sam had been dozing off in bed, but as soon as he heard the front door, he leapt out and ran down the stairs to greet and hug his older brother. He really does adore Jamie. As good and healthy as this brotherly love is, I secretly felt a bit miffed not to have first dibs in the hugs. I got to have my cuddles with Sam later, snuggled up in his bed while I sang him a lullaby and massaged his back. Jamie stopped me singing him lullabies when he turned 5. Frankly, I can't blame him. It was always the same song, and my skills in that department are woefully lacking. Jamie told me he was no longer a baby, and please could I stop. Sad face. I'm dreading Sam saying the same thing. I'll feel ever more redundant in the motherhood department as their independence grows. As I kissed each goodnight, I said my daily silent prayer of thanks to Tabitha, without whom the crazy life we lead would be so different. She has transformed our universe beyond measure. The joy I see on their faces when we play in the park, at home, or muck about on the boat, and the easy cuddles they have for me, makes me burst with happiness. They have the biggest hearts and beautiful loving natures. They are truly special. They did not arrive without the usual challenges, but our boys are the most wonderful gift anyone could ever give us. Chapter 20. The Future. At this date, we are not limited by the science. We are limited by our ability to make good use of the information and treatments we already have. Too often, lives are tragically ended not by cancer, but by the bureaucracy that came with the nation's investment in the war on cancer, by review boards, by the FDA, and by doctors who won't stand by their patients or who are afraid to take a chance. Dr. Vincent DeVita, former director of the NCI, National Cancer Institute, editor-in-chief of the Cancer Journal, and author of The Death of Cancer. It has become increasingly obvious that genetics only play a part of the equation. Even James Watson, DNA pioneer, with Francis Crick and Rosalind Franklin, is deeply frustrated by the slow progress in the field of cancer. Although initially hopeful about the Cancer Genome Atlas project that mapped out our entire genomic code, he recognized that sequencing DNA did not reveal the answer everyone hoped. Recently, Watson was heartened by the discovery that STAT3, a transcription code for the genes to tell them what to do, is involved in most, if not all, cancers. Importantly, STAT3 is now being recognized as a crucial key modulator of mitochondrial respiration, the way it makes energy, which firmly supports the metabolic theory rather than the genetic or somatic theory of oncogenesis, how cancer begins. STAT3, a transcription factor, has been shown to be altered first, triggered by inflammation. This then results in mutagenic changes that increase cancer's appetite for more nutrients, driving ever more rapid cell proliferation. There is now emerging evidence that metformin, the diabetic medication, blocks this malfunctioning pathway enough for James Watson to take metformin daily as prevention. But he is frustrated by the slow uptake of this simple intervention for every cancer patient. He has recently stated, "The depressing thing about the cancer moonshot is that it's the same people getting together, forming committees, and the same old ideas, and it's all crap." Indeed. Despite this, he is still positive that in 5 years' time he will see 80% of cancers becoming treatable, as do I. If my revolution takes off, I believe almost all stage 4 cancers can be reversed from being incurable to becoming treatable, unless organ damage is too severe, with the right combination of drugs given at the right time and in the right order. All too often, death is a result of too aggressive chemotherapy or a side effect of the toxic therapies currently on offer, as nearly happened to me. My brush with fatal therapy-related leukemia was a little too close for comfort. We need to embrace a more comprehensive approach, combining lower toxicity drugs and natural therapies, to achieve a gentle remission, one that gets the patient better without killing the patient in the process. Currently, patients receive aggressive and cruel treatments, using too much chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and indeed too aggressive surgery. I firmly believe we can cure cancer if we took a better approach to what and how we use all the drugs already at our disposal. I am convinced the answer to cancer has been out there all along. Many of the solutions buried and lost in piles of old scientific journals, just waiting for us to uncover. And discovering them was a matter of piecing the old information and piecing data together like a jigsaw. Fitting the metabolic parts together, both natural and pharmaceutical, into cancer-starving combinations. Had I stumbled across a cure? The McClelland Moonshot. Instead of the current deeply flawed approach of treating genetic changes alone, surely the answer is to treat the genetic, metabolic, and altered cell signaling together. This is my moonshot. 1. Starve your cancer, my MetroMap. 2. Stop abnormal cell signaling, Hedgehog, Wnt, Notch, PPAR gamma, inflammation. 3. Stop it spreading, block growth factors and MMPs. 4. Snuff it out, trigger apoptosis in a more gentle and natural way through the caspase cascade and oxygenation. Use low-dose chemotherapy and radiotherapy. 5. Recover, which includes detox, recovering the immune system, and mitochondrial loss. In that order, pulsing the apoptosis so that any dead cells can be safely cleared without too much toxic buildup. Dr. Shi Van Dang, director of the Abramson Cancer Center in Pennsylvania, also believes the answer is to deprive the cancer of its fuel, recognizing the insatiable appetite of the cancer cell. He acknowledges that they are addicted to nutrients, and without enough fuel, they just wither and die. Without a constant supply of food, cancer cannot survive. So, is it possible that managing cancer, or even a cure, could be as simple as taking a handful of cheap old drugs, with few side effects, alongside a modified lifestyle and cancer-starving diet? Imagine that in the future you are unluckily diagnosed with cancer, but only a stage 1 or stage 2. How simple and convenient it would be if all you had to do was wander down to the chemist to pick up a prescription for a few drugs, and then receive some dietary and lifestyle advice. Advanced cancers might need more than this approach, with longer-term management of diet and lifestyle, and with the patient continuing to take a few of the drugs. Could this be the answer to maintaining a lasting remission, much like HIV is controlled today? In my vision of the future, I see oncologists and patients working together with many other health professionals, but they will need to be specialists. Each cancer patient will need a tailored diet and exercise regime. Every cancer is driven by different metabolic and genetic changes, which is why there can never be one specific recommendation. If your disease is more glutamine-driven, e.g. cancers with an overexpressed MYC gene, it may be important to follow a more vegan diet, cutting out protein. melanomas, prostate, and BRAF-driven cancer.